This evening's talk is going to be on the title of clairvoyance. Are you interested? How many people predicted I was going to talk on this subject this evening? The reason is because someone sent me an email a long time ago. Can we talk about the Buddhism and clairvoyance? And has Buddhism anything to say about the subject? And sometimes when people send those emails, I just stick them on my desk. And sometimes someone else comes up with a subject which is a bit more interesting. But because no one asked me anything this evening, I'm going to be talking about clairvoyance and Buddhism. So everyone's settled down now. And strange thing that sometimes that many of us have had experiences of actually knowing what's going to happen next. Or maybe we've gone to mediums or gone to people who call themselves clairvoyants and they've given predictions and sometimes they turn out right and sometimes they don't turn out right. And you know what's actually happening, and especially these monks in front of you, because we've been meditating a long time and people think we've got amazing psychic powers. Somebody was saying today about our global conference in June because they wanted some entertainment for the global conference, and they asked me, can I levitate in public, because that would really make the global conference a big success. And I said, no. And the reason why, I've said this before, why monks will never demonstrate their psychic powers, because if we do things like clairvoyance in practice, then of course you will all be asking me who's going to win the Melbourne Cup. And you'll all be asking me, please, can you get the lottery number? And now that's called stealing. Because if somebody buys those lottery tickets or gambles on some horse race, isn't it unfair that you've got an advantage because, you know, you go to some monk or clairvoyant and find out who really is going to win? So because of that, we don't do such things. And also that if we knew what was going to happen next and we told people, then imagine what the government would do. They'd employ me from the CIA. And I would never be able to come to this Buddhist center ever again because I'd be so busy just predicting what's going to happen, whether the next bomb is going to go off, or who's a terrorist and who's not a terrorist. And if you could levitate, as I said before, we've got the Commonwealth Games coming soon in Melbourne. And I'll be in there all the time doing the high jump. And that'd be very unfair because you'd have an advantage over other people. So we do not exhibit such things. But other people do. And sometimes, even like as monks, sometimes you say some things and people are listening very carefully. Is he telling the future there? Especially sometimes in the Asian tradition, they always think that monks can actually predict these things, give lottery numbers and stuff like that. And it's unfortunate that sometimes it's true. I remember just when I was even a young monk, only about 5 or 6 years, I was staying on this mountain just by myself in a remote part of Thailand, and it got to the time of the lottery. We used to joke in Thailand that no one knew when the Buddhist Sabbath were, when the full moon was, or the half moons, but they all knew when they were drawing the lottery. That was the most important day of the week for them. And so they were coming up to me 2 or 3 days before, and they asked me, look, you're a meditation monk. You must go into deep meditation and be able to help us. Can you give me the numbers? And sometimes they were coming and showing all the blisters in their hand. These were dirt poor people. And they said, oh, you'd be really uncompassionate if you don't tell us what the numbers were. Sometimes I was thinking of saying, okay, as long as you give me 10%. But of course we can't do things like that. And in the end, I just told them, no, I can't say that. And so they tried to trick me. They started to ask me these questions. And the question they asked me, said, how long are you going to stay here? And I said, I don't know. When are you going to leave? And I said, about 2 or 3 days. And he found out afterwards that when I said, I don't know, that means zero. 2 or 3 days, that means 5, 2 and 3. So most of the village bought 50. In the Thai, they have this illegal lottery. The last two numbers of the real lottery, that's what they bet on. And 50 came up. And I found that out because the next day the headman of the village came up to see me with his offsider. And they said that the whole village is very happy with you. You're a wonderful monk. Please stay here forever. And that's what they said. And so I had to leave straight away because that's not the reason why you hang around monks, just to get rich. And anyway, that sometimes you can make mistakes, because one of the things about clairvoyance is that for most people that sometimes they get it so right, but other times they're just so wrong. And what's actually going on there? I mention that because it's a story from my own family. It was one of my cousins, or rather my mother's cousins. And it's a very interesting story. It's part of my own old family folklore, just after the Second World War. Just for fun, like most people do. Just for interest, something to do, they went to see one of these famous mediums in London. This medium looked at her and said to her straight away, she was maybe, I don't know, late teens, early 20s, said to her, "You're going to marry a man called Donald Wolfries." She never knew anyone by that name. And it's not a common name. It's not like John Smith or something. Wolfries. And of course, she dismissed it as just something, just impossible, a stupid thing. But a couple of weeks later, she was at a dance. She met a nice young man. They were dancing together. And as they do when you dance with someone, he said, "Oh, what's your name?" He said, "Donald." "Uh-oh." "What's your surname?" "Wolfries." "Ah!" And they've been married now for about 50 or 60 years. And they're still together after all that time. And because that was so strange, I mean, what's the chances of doing that? That's unpredictable. There was actually obviously something there. Sometimes it happens. But there's dangers too. One of the senior Buddhists here in Western Australia, Professor Jayasurya, used to be the professor of sociology in UWA. He told me a story once, because one of his close friends was another professor, Professor Jayatilaki, who was a very, very devout Buddhist and wrote many books on Buddhism. A very brilliant man who came to an untimely death. The reason he came to an untimely death, because as a student, he too went to one of these clairvoyants, I think in the south of India or the north of Sri Lanka, I can't remember which. And again, that clairvoyant told this young student, "You are going to marry a girl by a certain name." And of course he never knew anyone by that name at all. But later on he met her and married her. The coincidence was so unlikely that he had full faith in that clairvoyant and used to go and visit him regularly. But one day the clairvoyant told him, said, "Now I can see your future, you're going to live to an old age." And because that clairvoyant had got it right once, he thought he'd always get it right. And so in his early 40s, Professor Jayatilaki had a small illness. But he was told he was going to live to an old age, so he never went to see the doctor until it was too late. He died in his mid-40s. And he died because he didn't go to see the doctor, because he believed in the clairvoyant's prophecy. That such a belief literally killed him. Which is why that when you actually look for clairvoyance, or you look for telling your future or stuff like that, the one thing which Buddhism makes very clear is that you cannot trust these things. You don't know if it's going to be true or not. Which is why that I told a story in my book, Opening the Door of the Heart, of the only time when Ajahn Chah told somebody's fortune. This was my teacher in Thailand. He was a very strict monk. He kept all the rules and the precepts which a monk is supposed to keep. But one day this man came to see him. He was one of the real supporters of the monastery. And he said to my teacher Ajahn Chah, "Ajahn Chah, you're a great meditator. I'm sure you're fully enlightened, and many people fully enlightened have these psychic powers. Please tell me my fortune." And like a good monk, he said, "I'm not allowed to do that. It's against the precepts," and there's good reasons for that. But the man would not be pushed aside that easily. The man reminded Ajahn Chah of a talk he'd given recently on gratitude. And this man reminded him that in the early days of Ajahn Chah's monastery, this man had actually fed him when no one else would come. He'd actually spent time ferrying Ajahn Chah from place to place when no one else could do this. He'd taken time off work. He'd given big donations to build a monastery. In fact, without this man's support, Ajahn Chah probably would not have had a monastery. Surely you've taught us to be grateful. Can't you be grateful to me for all the support and dana I've given and just tell me my fortune? And that was a very strong argument. And Ajahn Chah realized he was in a sticky situation. So he decided, for the only time in his life, to tell this guy's fortune. He said, "Give me your hand. I will read from the lines on the palm what your fortune's going to be." This was the only time, the only person Ajahn Chah did this to. So you can imagine how excited this man was. But Ajahn Chah took his time. You've got to be careful on these things, otherwise you might make a mistake. And so very slowly Ajahn Chah, he traced the lines on this man's palm with his finger. And every few moments he would pause and say, that's interesting. Oh, look at that. My, my. And every time Ajahn Chah would say something like this, you could see this man's level of excitement go to another level. As you would do if I would read your fortune, and if you believed I would tell it absolutely correctly, wouldn't you be excited? And this was that man. This was not Ajahn Chah, Ajahn Chah, the great Arahat. And so when Ajahn Chah finished, this man couldn't wait to find out what his future would be, what his fortune would be. Because he knew that Ajahn Chah, he would never tell a lie. And he was so wise and so powerful that whatever he said must be true. And what Ajahn Chah said actually did turn out to be right. He predicted this man's fortune perfectly. It was amazing. Because when Ajahn Chah said, "I know what your future is going to be." The man said, "Yes, please tell me." Ajahn Chah said, "Your future, sir, is uncertain." And he wasn't wrong. Now that was the brilliance of a great teacher. Because he knew he was not going to be, this man would not be just stopped by just saying, no, I can't do it according to my precepts. So Ajahn Chah was teaching him why monks can't tell fortunes. Because your fortune, your future is uncertain. No one can truly predict it. All they can say is likelihoods of what might happen. Sometimes those likelihoods actually turn out to be true, and it's only afterwards we think, wow, that's a good clairvoyant. You notice if it doesn't turn out to be true, no one goes there again. And you only get praised by the people who you actually predict the future correctly for. That is one of the problems. So because of that, so you always have to remember with clairvoyance that, you know, what actually you're teaching there. Sometimes it is so uncertain. But when Ajahn Chah teaches the future, he actually included that in the fortune teller. The future is uncertain. And that is clear seeing what clairvoyance truly means. Sure, there is tendencies, things which might happen, but you can always change things. The law of karma in Buddhism means that yes, there's tendencies, influences, things which are pressing on you. But with wisdom, with diligence, with skill, you can always turn things around. You are not fated for anything in life. You're always constantly changing and creating your future. Which is why when people ask, "Does Buddhism believe in a creator?" they say, "Yes, you." You are continually creating your future. And that is something you don't need to believe in a book, because you can see it in your life. basically you are the person most in charge of your destiny. Sure that life can give you different ingredients, but how you use those ingredients is completely up to you. So when you say about predicting the future, no one can predict that because you can change it if you want to. It's really up to you. And that is a powerful teaching, which is much, much better than telling you what the next lottery number is going to be, or who's going to win the Melbourne Cup, or what's going to happen next. Because if you did predict that future, not only would it be inaccurate and be deceiving people, but number two, it would be taking away the most important part of life. It's like giving a person the answer to the exams at school. That stops the point of why we have examinations in school, why we have tests. Because these are there not just to pass, but this is there to learn. The school is not actually to get the degree at the end. The school is there to learn, to get information, to know, to find out. That's what we have universities and schools for. That's what we have life for. So it takes away the meaning of life. If we could predict what's going to happen. So because of that, the future is uncertain, and anybody who has some idea what's going to happen would never actually let you know. Because sometimes you do get it wrong. Another story which comes up, one of the fellow monks who, you know, was the same year as me when we joined the monkhood, where we're at Ajahn Chah's Thai monastery, he, a couple of times, he had some psychic ability. Because he told me that once, well, he had this recurring dream. He was from the US, his father was in the American Army, a colonel or something. He was very wealthy family. They lived in Pasadena in a big house with swimming pool, a guest house, everything. And he told me that, because he was very close to me, we sat next to each other in the line for many years. He told me that when he was young, he had this recurring dream. It always occurred at the swimming pool of his family home, and he saw his young sister drown in the family swimming pool. He said that one day he was sitting by that pool, just relaxing, just a young man, and the dream started to play itself out. Exactly as he dreamed many times was actually happening in real life. Because he knew what was going to happen next, he intervened and he saved his sister's life. He said it was only because of the dream, because he'd had it play to himself and he remembered it many, many times. Only that actually saved his sister's life. He said he had another dream many years later when he was actually in New Zealand, just travelling and working. He said at that time he was in a house of other young people. And like many young people of that age, they were smoking illegal substances. And he had a dream that the New Zealand police raided the house and caught him. He had that dream many times, but this time, because of his stupidity, he never took any action. And it happened. And he got deported. But those two instances thought that these dreams which he had would have to be true. And so when he was a monk in Thailand, this was the time of the Vietnam War. It was a time when our monastery was just, you know, maybe an hour, half an hour from the border where the Viet Cong, the Pathet Lao, the Khmer Rouge were. And where those areas of Thailand were supposed to be invaded by those communist troops. Even the governments, the Western governments and the embassies in Bangkok really did think that the northeast of Thailand would fall. There were emergency evacuation plans. We were told of them and told when they come, this is what you should do. So it was really a serious threat. And this monk always had the dream that when the invasion of northeast Thailand came from the communist troops over the border, that he wouldn't make it. He always dreamt of running across a paddy field and being shot by the communist invaders. And he was so sure, because of the two earlier dreams which had been true, that this was his destiny, that he would get shot. And of course it never happened. He was shot in a sense, because he fell in love with a girl, disrobed, and got married. And a year later he died in a car crash, a head-on collision. Not by shots. He was wrong. It was one of those cases from my experience where you see that sometimes what we predict is going to happen, even though we're sure it's going to happen, sometimes it doesn't, because life is always changing. The things are always interfering with our so-called destiny. Ourselves, we create the destiny, and other people sometimes interfere with it as well. So you can't really be sure. Which is why I keep telling people, never trust a poor fortune teller. If they're worth anything, surely they'd be filthy rich themselves. If you see me struggling to raise funds for our retreat center, why do you ask me to give you a lottery number? Figure it out for yourself. But still, people want to find this out. That being said, that sometimes, and I've mentioned, sometimes there is, you know, like a seeing of the future, or seeing of what's going to happen, or a deeper seeing into the nature of things, which is really weird. Okay, sometimes you get it wrong, but people ask, how on earth can you get it right sometimes? How on earth can, you know, that person actually predict the name, like Donald Wolfries, which my mother's cousin actually married? How can that be done? And this is actually where the Buddhist practice of meditation really does actually come up to explain these things. Because we all know that in, you know, Buddhism, we make a huge thing about this thing we call the mind. And Buddhism always says six senses, not just the five of seeing, hearing, smelling, touching, always six. As I've joked before, that is not an Eastern invention. That was part of the Western heritage, because Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, especially Aristotle, always talked about six senses, the mind as well. Somehow we lost that sixth sense. My joke is that somewhere in the history of Western civilization, we lost our mind. We only had five senses left. And actually, Aristotle, it's interesting, he actually called that mind, he called it the common sense, because it's common to all the other five senses. So my second joke is we also lost our common sense. We lost our mind. We lost the spiritual heart of things. And because we never actually even thought that a mind existed, we never really cultivated it at all, that's why that we don't have any sort of abilities in that area at all in Western world. But if you do cultivate the mind, especially in meditation, you find it gets powerful. It gets very, very strong. Now, the way that actually happens, you've heard me describe in meditation retreats, and I'll just mention it very briefly here. When your energy, you know, your energy of being, you might call it mental energy if you like, you might call it chi or the winds in the body or whatever. When that energy is all used up in the frantic hurry and bustle of your life, doing things, coming here, going there, it doesn't give enough energy just to the pure mind, just to the knowing nature. And it's because we're so active, so much doing, so much thinking, that is the reason why our minds have become very, very weak. Two parts of the mind, the doer and the knower. The doer is the active part, which thinks, which plans, which complains, which makes your body move. You know, the doing part of the mind. The second part of the mind is the knower, the passive mind, which just receives the information. We give so much energy to this doing, to thinking, to planning, to moving, that there's hardly any energy is left just for knowing. That's why we're dull. And what you find in meditation, the whole purpose of meditation is not to do anything, not to plan, not to control. So that active part of the mind, the doer, is calmed down. It stops consuming the energy, and the energy is now free to flow into the knowing, into the mind, into passive awareness. And this is one of the reasons why when you start to meditate, you start to become clear-minded. The mind starts to become energized. You start to be able to see and hear things, become more sensitive to the world around you. And that's usually experienced by meditators, that increasing brightness, happiness, the mindfulness becomes empowered. And I've, in my meditation teachings, I've coined the word power mindfulness, because that's what it feels like. You can actually see more deeply into things. You can hear more. You can feel more. You can actually see more. And you can also know much more. The experiences which I've had with in the early years as a meditator, you know, sometimes you just go outside and look at the night sky, and my goodness, it's brilliant. You know, whatever you see seems to have a deeper, richer texture and color. There are times on a meditation retreat when you look at the carpet, just like the carpet which is in front of you now, just this dull, ordinary, cheapo carpet bought by the Buddhist Society. It's lasted a long time though. But how many of you have really looked at this carpet and see just how beautiful it is? You think, why? It's just an old carpet, that's all. What happens sometimes when you get into deep meditation? Your mind becomes so powerful. The energy starts to increase. You look upon a little piece of carpet like that, it starts to look beautiful. And you start to see so many different colors in there, so many different shapes. You actually see much more in a simple piece of carpet than you've ever seen in your whole life. And it becomes absolutely beautiful, captivating, and full of detail which you'd never expected. And I call that power mindfulness simply because it shows the carpet has always been like that, but now your mind has become strong. You can see much more of what's going on in there. And it's part of meditation to make that mind more and more powerful by making it more and more still and allowing, not doing, but just knowing. This is the way we actually empower the mind, and sometimes your mind gets so powerful because you are very still, you're not doing very much. You can understand where those psychic powers actually come from. The mind is energized, and a powerful mind, just like a powerful body, can do things which for other people are impossible. And it's that powerful mind is the cause of clairvoyance. You can actually see, but the real clairvoyance, the real person who knows, will never actually say this is what's going to happen. We'll only see the tendencies to say this is likely to happen. You can see sort of not just the particulars of the future, but the flow of the future. And one thing that a wise person would always say is that when you see the flow of the future, you can see just this world is not going to end in a short time. You can see just the way of human beings. We're going to keep this life going some way or another. Well, many, 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 many more centuries. You don't actually need to be a clairvoyant to see that. Anyone who says the end of the world is nigh, the end of the world is nigh. I remember reading a newspaper about a guy who used to do that. He was actually walking with his placard. He used to actually be on the corner of the of Vincent Street and Charles Street. Because on a Sunday afternoon when we used to finish here, we used to go back to Serpentine. We always used to go that way. You see this guy all the time. With his sign, the end of the world is nigh, repent. We always used to wave to him, and he would wave back. And we would say, see you next week. He didn't like that. But you know, in the end, he was right. He got knocked over by a car and killed. It's true. For him, the end of the world was nigh one day. It's a sick joke, but it was true. But of course, a lot of those predictions which people make sometimes are making it for ulterior motives. They're predicting it just to make you afraid. But the truth of the matter is, you know, you can actually see that that's never going to happen. Just the way of human beings is we always adapt. Clairvoyance is seeing clearly. Already, I think somebody said this the other day to me. They said, look, there's so many hurricanes, tsunamis, earthquakes. It's a sign. The end of the world is happening. And they say, you're not seeing clearly. That's not clairvoyance. People always sometimes focus on what goes wrong. But I said, how many hurricanes didn't happen last week? How many earthquakes weren't there in the world? How many tsunamis didn't occur? And that's far, far greater. To be really clairvoyant, we have to see the full picture. And the full picture is, yeah, sometimes these things happen, sometimes they don't. Most of the times they don't. And human beings are always adapting. So the world isn't going to end that quickly. But when we have these predictions, we should always use them wisely. These are just telling us roughly what's going to happen. And it's up to us not to be victims of such fate, but actually to make use of it. That's why that law of karma is not saying, I am doomed to be like this forever. If you're ugly, you're not doomed to be ugly. You can always get a facelift these days. It's amazing how you can change your karma. Whatever it is, there's always something you can do about it. But that's only like part of clairvoyance. But once you understand how the mind can be empowered, you can understand how these things can be done. And sometimes they do happen. And the best times they happen is when you can't predict them. You can't make them happen. It's interesting that people who do develop those psychic powers, they can't make them to order. It's not like going into sort of, you know, like a drive-in clairvoyance and, you know, please can tell me what the future is. And just do it to order. Because each one of these events of clairvoyance or psychic powers, they come from the stillness of the mind when it doesn't do things. If you try and do things, it always messes up. You can't force these things. They happen by natural causes. And you have to keep those natural causes in place. Even like sort of, you know, the psychic powers of levitation, sometimes it's natural causes that make that happen. If the causes aren't there, it doesn't happen. Now, just there's a story I often tell about levitation. And it's a story from the old suttas. And it's a story about the monk who actually was in a forest for many, many, many years, and he learned how to levitate, to fly through the air. And he would always go for his morning exercise every morning in the forest, flying through the air. But that's a very dangerous thing to do, simply because someone saw him. And then once they saw him, he started to get a reputation. And the reputation, because imagine, if you saw a person flying through the air, what would you do? You tell your friends. Actually, here you probably tell sort of the ABC or somebody. But anyhow, the word got to the king. And the king realized that someone who could actually fly through the air, obviously, was a very, very good meditator and probably had great sort of wisdom as well. So he wanted to invite this monk to come and demonstrate his abilities and also to be like an advisor, like a spiritual guide to the king. So he invited this monk to come to the palace. And of course the monk refused. Yeah, I'm a forest monk. I like to live in the jungles. It's nice and peaceful. I don't want to live in a palace. So having refused the king then sent his army. So then he went to the palace. And the king was very kind. He actually made an area of the palace into a small forest for this monk. And fascinatingly, the king of Thailand has also made, in his palace, in Chitlada Palace, a little one-acre forest. Because many years ago we had a Thai monk, Ajahn Lien, came to visit us for Akatina, and the year afterwards I visited Thailand, he invited me to come for lunch in the palace. And so just next to where the king of Thailand lives is this little forest. He's planted it like a forest in the northeast or somewhere else in Thailand, a little monk's hut in there, and you go right inside this little forest, only 1 acre, in this little hut, and even though you're in the middle of Bangkok, as far as you're concerned, you may be in the middle of nowhere. And this was a little hut, and he had this monk, Ajahn Lien, actually staying there. So the king could actually offer dana, offer food to his, you know, favorite monk. And when he had a few minutes, he had the monk there so he could actually ask questions and discuss dharma. You know, having a sort of monk in your garden, it was. Don't get any ideas. It's interesting, I said this the other day, that when the first monks went to England, and they were thinking, how can we look after these monks, all this food they need, and you know, have to get them health care or whatever. And somebody actually worked out how much it cost to look after one monk. And they figured out, actually, looking after a monk is much cheaper than looking after a dog. So they said every home should have one. Just have a pet dog in the garden. They only live in like a small hut, you know, like a dog kennel. You take them for a walk every morning, give them one bowl of food. We eat out of bowls as well, just like... But anyhow, so this king brought this monk into his palace and put him in a nice little hut, in a nice little forest. And the monk was quite happy for a while. The king would actually come and give him some food and ask him some questions about Dhamma, about life, wisdom and stuff. And he would go for his flight every morning, and the king would look at him and get inspired that these things actually happened. But then what went wrong? That one day, the king was busy, so he sent one of his daughters to bring the food to this monk. And this was a very, very beautiful young woman. And when, you know, like princesses usually are, and when actually she brought the food to the monk was just actually coming back, you know, from his morning flight. And way up there in the air, he saw this princess. She was gorgeous. And he had one moment of lust. And now you know what a crash landing is. He lost his abilities right there and then, and he came crashing to the ground. And he realized that the dangers, how sensitive is it actually to keep those clairvoyant powers? They come from causes, the purity of the mind, and deep meditation and simplicity. And he realized that you can't actually do that in the great cities. So he had to walk back to his forest. And according to the story, it took him about 3 years to get those abilities back. That's how sensitive, real clairvoyance and real powers truly are. You have to have a very, very pure mind. That's actually quite good in a sense, because it's like a safety mechanism. If anybody abuses those powers, like uses clairvoyance for personal gain, or to become some big shot, look at me. If they have that degree of ego and desire, then you lose all those powers. And there has been, some saintly figures, and even current ones, who are reputed to have all these clairvoyant powers or psychic powers. They can do things which amaze people, and sometimes people have checked them out and it looks really real. We have noticed that sometimes they have these powers when they're young, but they tend to lose them later on in their life. And the reason is because sometimes they forget the purity of their lifestyle, the purity of their intentions, and because they get caught up in worldly things, they lose it. That's what happens sometimes. So the real clairvoyance, people who really do have such powers, they come because of the causes of a very peaceful mind, a simple lifestyle, very, very pure-hearted, selfless, giving. Those sorts of people have a very strong mind and get into deep meditation. They can get those powers, but they will not use them for personal gain. Sometimes they wouldn't even use them at all. They would hide them, because for the sake of simplicity, for the sake of teaching Dhamma, because that's what they really want to give people. Okay, so you can fly through the air. So what? Big deal. What's the point of that? Now, if monks actually did that, they'd just be circus stars, that's all. Just freaks, strange things. And also that you get all these scientists and psychologists that would be hooking you up to all sorts of machines to try and find out how you did it or try to disprove it. And you never have a moment's peace. And it's not the point of life to be able to do such things. Another point of life is actually wisdom, peace, compassion. Sometimes it's inspiring to actually know such things exist, but there's some things which are more and more important in life. Know that peace exists, know that happiness exists, know that wisdom exists. So when the Buddha was actually predicting things, he would actually predict things that more like according to cause and effect, saying, look, if you develop kindness and compassion in your life, then you'll be rich. not rich with lots of money, but rich with lots of happiness. If you forgive other people, you'll have a lot of friends, and you'll have peace in your heart. That's a prediction. What is it saying is if you put these causes into place, this is what will happen. And those are the predictions which Buddhism likes to give. You know, if you are generous, you'll have lots of happiness. The times I've been generous, I always remember the donations, the kindness which I've given in my life as a monk, and especially before I was a monk. Little things which I gave. One of the greatest gifts which I gave, now monetary gifts, was when as a student, a poor student, I went to a talk by a Tibetan nun. And she didn't give a great talk on, you know, theoretical Buddhism. All she did was tell us about the orphanage she was running somewhere in the north of India. And I thought, what a kind lady that was. And so the following morning, I was so inspired, I went to my bank and I drew out £10. This was in 1969 or 1970. You may not think that is much, but for me that was 2 weeks' food money. I went hungry because of that donation. It hurt me, you know, physically. But that was one of the greatest donations I've ever made. I never regret that, because that gives me so much happiness to know what I did. And little things like that, you know, prove the prediction of the Buddha. And if you're kind and generous to somebody, you'll always get lots of happiness back. We call it small investment, great returns. Stock market, you can never trust it. You can't predict that. But karma, generosity, you can always predict. Just forgiveness when someone's harmed and hurt you. You just forgive them. It's amazing, just you can predict how it will bring peace and harmony to this world. To your world in particular. You can predict that if you're compassionate and kind, you help other beings. The other beings will be kind and compassionate to you. You can predict that. You know, I spent my life as a monk trying to be kind and generous, and giving what I can give. I can't give money, but at least I can give my time. And soon I'll be traveling overseas. I don't really need insurance. You know what my insurance is? Or my good karma. If I get sick while I'm in Thailand, people will be fighting to look after me. Please come to my hospital. No, you went to that hospital last time. Please come to mine. Same as in London or in US. So many people who are looking after you. That's why whenever I do get sick, I try and hide it. Whenever I've got sick here, I've had this whole line of medicines come afterwards. And everyone says, I've got this special medicine for you, Ajahn Brahm, please take it. And then someone else comes up and said, I've got my special medicine, please take this as well. And someone else comes up, no, please take mine. And they won't leave me until I promise to take them. So I have to take them all, and that really makes me sick. It happens sometimes. It's just like the dharana time. And you see me, I'm putting on weight. I can't help it, because people actually come and say, I made this specially for you, Ajahn Brahm. Please take it. And they do, and you've got to take it, even if you don't like it, you just have to take it. I made this specially for you. I made this specially for you. I made this specially for you. I don't care. I think it's more important that sort of you recognize people's kindness and generosity and you put it in the mouth. Okay, you know, you may be overweight, but you've got a happy heart, and you're creating happiness amongst others. Who cares? Even though the body may be overweight, the mind is just so healthy. And I think that's the most important thing. So this way of actually predicting the future, the kindness and generosity, that's what we can predict. But people aren't interested in that. They want to know who's going to win the Melbourne Cup. They want to know how their stocks and shares are going to do. They want to know what's going to happen in the future, who they're going to marry, whether they should do this and should do that. And of course, that's the predictions of stupid people. So please, when we talk about clairvoyance, understand that yes, sometimes it's true, but sometimes it's false. You cannot trust it. So you have to be careful there. I'm tempted to tell the story about the five angels, but I think I've told that many times before. It's in the book. Maybe just to check out, put your hand up if you haven't heard the story of the five angels. Wow, you guys should read my book. But anyway, it's a great story. Whenever I start saying I don't know whether I should or I shouldn't, you can predict I will. Because this is a great story about what happens, about predictions. Because this is about prophetic dreams. Because sometimes, you ever had one of those dreams, which is so real? And sometimes they turn out to be true. But you know, only afterwards you really understand what they truly meant. Because this particular dream, this guy, over here in Perth some years ago, he dreamt of five angels. And each angel had his five pots of gold. And they lined up to give this guy 25 pots full of gold. It's worth a fortune. And just as he received the last pot of gold, as usually happens in such dreams, he woke up in his bedroom. There were no angels in his bedroom, but even worse, there were no pots of gold. It was only a dream. However, when he went downstairs, to his surprise, he found his wife that morning had made him five boiled eggs and five pieces of toast. Well, that's a bit weird. What's with this magic number five? You can think what it was like when he looked at the newspaper and he realized it was the 5th of May. May was the fifth month. Sometimes you have an understanding there that there's some omen there, that something is happening. So he looked at the back of the newspaper, the racing. And as many of you who live here know, there's a race course called Ascot. He noticed, A-S-C-O-T, five letters. So he looked straight away at race number five. And you can imagine his surprise when horse number five was called Five Angels. Now you can't get sort of more of a coincidence than that. So he took the afternoon off work. He never told his wife. He drew $5,000 out of the bank to keep the lucky number five. Went to the racetrack. He chose the fifth bookmaker in line to keep the lucky number five. $5,000 to win horse number five, race number five, Five Angels. Because when you had such coincidence, I mean, it can't be wrong. The lucky number five couldn't be wrong. And it wasn't wrong. His horse came in fifth. Even if you heard it before, it's a good joke. And the moral of that story is, yeah, it was predicted. Five. But too often we just misunderstand what the story's going to be. And so sometimes we can't trust those predictions and clairvoyance. So those sorts of predictions which you actually get from clairvoyance, from mediums or from monks or whatever, please never actually believe them. Don't stake all your life on those predictions because it's uncertain. And it will turn out in the end. The great clairvoyant people like Ajahn Chah would always say that from the very beginning. Life is uncertain. The future is uncertain. You cannot predict it. So stop planning and worrying all of these things. It's a great clairvoyance to know the future is uncertain because you don't know what's going to happen. Isn't that wonderful? It means you have nothing to worry about. On Monday, I start a trip overseas. I don't know how many flights I have to take. Maybe 20 or 30. So the probability of having some sort of accident for me is actually quite high. I might get a terrorist attack and get blown up at 30,000 feet. But I always tell people about the three advantages of being blown up in an aircraft at 30,000 feet. Do you remember those three advantages? Number one is an instant cremation, so you don't have to pay for a funeral director. Number two, the airline company will give a payment, the insurance, so you actually get paid for dying. And number three, dying way up there, you're halfway to heaven anyway. There's a lot of advantages. But why is it that when we look for predictions, we always think of the rotten things which will happen? So much worry about the future becomes when we predict the very worst which will happen to us. It's not clairvoyance, it's almost like a masochistic voyance of the future, where we always look at what might go wrong. And the way of Buddhism is not to look what will go wrong, but to look at what might go right. I'll finish off with a story which couldn't go into my book simply because of copyright, but I can say it. It was one of the stories from Winnie the Pooh. When Winnie the Pooh and Piglet were walking in the forest one evening during a storm, they were a long way from home. The storm was getting worse. Branches were falling down, and then whole trees were being uprooted by the hurricane. And they were so scared. And once, during the height of the storm, little Piglet, Winnie the Pooh's friend, was so scared he could not go on any longer. He looked at Winnie the Pooh and said, "I can't go on. I'm so terrified. What would happen if a tree fell when we were underneath it?" And that was a real possibility. And for a few moments, even Winnie the Pooh was scared too. But he had wisdom. He replied, "What would happen if a tree didn't fall on us when we were underneath it?" And that was the end of fear. When we predict the future, why is it we always think about what's going to go wrong? Why is it that we always worry about failure? Why can't we predict the future? It's uncertain, so why don't we predict it in a positive way? Not what might go wrong, but what might go right. So if you're about to get married, instead of thinking, the ceremony's tomorrow, what might go wrong? How about thinking about what might go right? On Sunday, Sister Ajahn Wayama's having a Katina ceremony. Last time I looked in the newspaper, it was going to rain. What would happen if it would rain? I would say, what would happen if it didn't rain? And then she could get a good night's sleep. So in all of these times when we worry too much about the future, because we add negativity to our predictions, and the clairvoyance, the true clear seeing, is understanding the future, it is uncertain, as Ajahn Chah predicted. It always will be uncertain. We don't know what it's going to be. So if you are going to plan the future and think about the future, because it's uncertain, why don't you think in a positive way? And it's a strange thing that if you think in a positive way, those things usually happen. We had our Katina ceremony last Sunday at Bodhinyana Monastery. Did you notice? Thursday, it rained. Friday, it rained. Saturday, it rained. Sunday, when we had our Katina ceremony, was a wonderful sunny day. Monday it rained, Tuesday it rained, Wednesday it rained, Thursday it rained. Strange things happened, isn't it? And with about a week or 2 weeks of rain, we had one sunny day, and that's the day we had our Katina ceremony. Why do you think that happened? Was that clairvoyance? Or was it just positive thinking? Instead of worrying, what would happen if it rains? We thought, what would happen if it didn't rain? And that's what happened. Now you understand, not predicting the future, but creating the future. Making it work. So if you have got a biopsy next week, and you think, what if I've got cancer? Why about, if you think like that, sometimes you get it. Worry is a great cause of cancer, you know. But if you think, what if I don't have cancer? You're increasing your chances of not getting it. Do you understand? We create the future, not life. So we talk about clairvoyance. This is clear seeing. And it's also positive seeing. Because this does make you rich and healthy, safe and happy. And isn't that what we really wanted clairvoyance for in the first place? You don't get that by being told what's going to happen. You get that by listening to things like Dhamma, which shows you what's really going on with this clairvoyance business. Uncertainty, You are the creator, you can change things. So instead of worrying or being concerned what someone says, you take responsibility, you take control and go and do it. And that is really clear seeing, what clairvoyance truly means. So I hope you enjoyed this talk today about clairvoyance. Thank you very much. Now, are there any questions anyone is going to ask? I predict there will be no questions. That's a lot of wishful thinking, you know, I'm trying to create the future. Unfortunately, are there any questions? Yeah, there's one at the back here. You see, the future's uncertain. Yeah, go on. Yeah. Okay, the idea of spirits in other religions, sometimes like we call that like the mind or like the stream of consciousness. That's actually how we usually describe this like in traditional Buddhism. But really, it doesn't really matter what the words are. We actually look at, don't actually what the words actually say, it's actually what it means, what it's pointing to. So in Buddhism, actually, no, we don't believe in spirits. It's against the fifth precept. Now, come on. It's not that tired. But, you know, there is such a thing. Actually, I told that joke to Abbot Placid. He's one of my friends from the New North Sea. I went to see him some months ago and asked him whether, you know, Benedictine monks, whether they believe in ghosts. Because that abbot, that Eunorcian monastery is very, very old. So, do you believe in ghosts? He said, no, I don't believe in ghosts. What about the Holy Ghost then? I caught you. And he laughed. He knows my sense of humour. But spirits, yeah. The idea of like of a spirit, it actually comes from actually the word, you know, the same word to breath, to, you know, to respire. Is actually to breathe in and breathe out, you know, to aspirate. Because, you know, in ancient times, they thought the breath was actually almost like a soul. Because when you stop breathing, you die. And that's actually why, I don't know if you know sort of language, the word for breath in Latin is animalis. That's where we get the word animal from, literally means having breath. And any of you who know Buddhism, or even Sanskrit, Hinduism, prana, prana is the same word for animals. Prana in Pali, prana in Sanskrit is like a being. It's like breath. So, like ancient times, we always thought like the breath is actually an important part of the being. That's where we get the word spirit from. That's its derivation. But they just use these different words actually to describe some essence of a person. And the only way you can find what that is actually to go deep inside and look for yourself. That's what meditation does, to find out what this word spirit, mind, soul, being truly is. So that's what you do. But you heard me say today, when you actually do go deep in meditation, when you do actually empower the mind, what people say empower the spirit, that's actually where you do get some very strong supernormal power sometimes. But you have to be very careful, because anyone who has power, they say power corrupts, simply because you know that, you know, you think you have a big ego, but there is a balancing mechanism. If you do exert that ego, you lose your powers, which is helpful. It means that people can't really abuse the powers, at least not for long. Abuse them, you lose them. Anyone got any other questions? Well, my prediction wasn't that far off. Only one. Oh, there's two questions. It's really off, wasn't it? Okay, go on.
In which connection is clairvoyance with astrology, tarot, magic balls, and things like that?
Oh, with astrology, there was. Yeah, well, that's a big question, but the clairvoyance and astrology. There's a great piece of research was done about 20, 25 years ago when some astrologers did the charts of some great saints in India. And you know, they wanted to actually to see, this was their predictions, you know, for astrology, and actually what actually happened to them. And I remember this because they actually confirmed what I always understood from my Buddhist practice. They found that, yeah, you can see these influence on these, you know, these holy men in India. But these holy men, because of their practice, because of their purity, because of the power of their meditation, they actually change the course of their destiny. What they're actually saying is actually proved very, very clearly that, yeah, you can see those influence, but they sort of use them, change them, like changing the course of a current. It's, for example, the best simile which I can give, because I live in the forest, I know about bushfires now, and it's coming up to bushfire season. And the way you don't fight and block bushfires, because you can't stop those things. The way to do is actually to move them around, to actually to guide them so they go away from their houses, so they go into a place where they can just burn themselves out. So you almost like direct them. You've got this incredible powerful flow, and you just push it a little bit that way. And that's actually what these guys were doing with their, you know, the tendencies of their life. They could still change everything. And this is actually what I mean about we are the creators. So yeah, astrology, like, you know, any clairvoyance, they can give you an indication of the sort of things which might happen, but they are never absolutely true. And you can always do something about it. You can always change it. And that's actually what happens. And the, you know, the crystal ball things, it's actually, if you meditate, it's very easy to understand what's going on there, simply because, you know, those people who get into deep meditation, when you get into things like nimittas, all you're really doing is actually using that ball as a focus of your meditation, to actually to allow the five senses to actually disappear, to stop all the thinking, and actually get access to your mind. Okay. That's right, yeah. You see, it was meant to be, wasn't it? But no, so some of these things, I remember reading a little story once in a magazine about this fellow, and he used to go around to school fates, you know, reading people's fortunes. And he said actually that, you know, he was a con. He admitted it was a con. You know, he said it's very easy because when people want to believe, they will always believe anything. And it was actually just raising money for the kids, that's all. And he got very good at it. He started to dress himself up. He gave himself some funny name. I think he was a man, but he cross-dressed. It was Madame Zola or something, I don't know. And he'd always say, before they come in, he'd peer through the tent, have a quick look at them, who they were, and he'd get lots of information. He said he'd learned the tricks of the trade. He was very, very good. But I always remember, I don't know if you know a group called the Skeptic Society. They live over in Sydney and stuff. There's Dick Smith, it's in there, Philip Adams, you know, all these sort of, you know, very rich intellectuals, but also a bit of larrikins as well. And they did this amazing scam a few years ago, which bears mentioning. They went over to UK and they hired an actor, a professional actor, not really well known, but, you know, a really good actor. And they paid him a huge sum of money and said, we want you to go around to see all these mediums in England. Learn the tricks of the trade. See how they speak, how they act. Because in 6 months' time, we're going to invite you to Sydney. We're going to actually to see, exercise if people are gullible or not. And of course, they never let on who was actually doing this. And before this fellow actually arrived in Sydney, they put advertisements, you know, in the newspapers, in the psychic news, whatever else it was, about this amazing psychic from, you know, UK who's being invited over at great expense and got a huge reputation. Just marketing, that's what it was. And they built this guy up. And they hired these really nice venues in Sydney. And many people went along. And soon his reputation was getting even greater. People were saying, oh, what a marvelous person this is. He's got it right, absolutely, all the time. And it was only after about a week they pulled the plug and said exactly what was going on. It was from the Skeptic Society, Philip Adams, Dick Smith, they all went up and said, look, we paid this guy, he's just an actor. It's a complete fake. But the object of the exercise is how easy it is to fool people. You believe what you want to believe. And that's a dangerous thing. But that being said, there are true clairvoyants. But they never would, the real clairvoyants would never say, this is what's going to happen. They say, this is a likelihood. That's why you cannot trust them to predict the winner of the Melbourne Cup. Okay. Well, I mean, the inventions through meditation. No, most inventions. No, most inventions came from drinking too much coffee. I always say the Industrial Revolution, sort of in Europe, where technology started, coincided with actually finding coffee and bringing it to Europe. Because too many people, instead of actually working in the fields, were sitting around the coffee houses drinking coffee with nothing better to do, thinking too much, and they came up with all these ideas, you know, canals and boats and locomotives and stuff like that. And that's actually why we've got such a complicated society. Coffee-driven. Interesting thesis, isn't it? I think someone should write a PhD on that. But a lot of time, I mean, why do you want to do these things? I mean, somebody actually gave me an electric toothbrush the other day. I mean, who would invent an electric toothbrush? I mean, I already mentioned I'm overweight. I need at least a bit of exercise. I mean, that's really... That really is a side of sort of like, you know, too much coffee and thinking what to do next. So if you don't think too much, life is peaceful. And most of these things you don't really need. And that's when life becomes nice and easy. If you keep thinking, there's no end of things you can think about and want. When the mind becomes calm and peaceful, simplicity becomes possible. Try it. Too much thinking creates too many problems. And sometimes, because of, you know, too much caffeine, people think just overmuch, and they create confusion. Somebody told me, actually, they were working in the government, even here. And people actually work in government offices. They've got such high pressure, they drink 6 or 7 cups of coffee a day, minimum. So imagine what happens in the White House. Now you understand where the problems come from. Anyway, that's just an idea. You may not just... Very good, thank you, yeah. Okay, thank you very much for listening today. Now we've got our announcements from our president.